Good afternoon, and thank you all for being with us today. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS. We're really delighted to have this panel of speakers here today with us to review the key outcomes from Mexico City. I want to particularly thank Kate Hoffler, Heather Texera, Suzanne Brundage, Eric Little from CSIS staff for putting this event together, and Alicia Carbow from Kaiser Family Foundation. Jen Cates and I have been doing this over the last several IAS meetings, bringing people together a month or two after, shortly after the meeting to review the outcomes. The interest has been very, very strong. It's been a great partnership undertaken with Kaiser Family Foundation, who are really our among our best partners here in the work that we've done over the years with the CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS. We've now launched here at CSIS a Center on Global Health Policy. A few meetings that we will be having that I would like to just bring to your attention. On the 29th of September at 4:30, from 4:30 to 6, followed by a reception in this space here, will be a launch of the center, and will involve a number of our advisory board members talking about the critical challenges that lie ahead in developing a strategic, long-term strategic approach on global health. We'll have Senator Bill Frist, Ed Scott, Dr. Jeff Sturgeon, Robert Mallett, and a few other folks there participating. It's meant to be very interactive, and I hope you will all join us. A few days before that, on September 23rd, we will be doing a program on U.S. military health programs in Africa. We'll be bringing together folks from the DHAP program in San Diego, the program that's begun the prevention and treatment programs military to military across Africa and elsewhere. We'll be bringing forward folks from Walter Reed who are involved with the labs and with direct assistance programs on lab equipment and training in Nigeria. And we'll have a leader from Stuttgart from the AFRICOM health side to talk about the vision that's emerging there. And we'll have a number of the partners on a second panel, which would be FHI, among others, and we'll have Tim Ziemer offer a keynote address at that. So please join us for that. That's September 23rd. I want to thank our speakers for coming. Jennifer is going to do the introductions, but I just want to emphasize here that Craig McClure was here with us earlier when we were attempting to raise the profile of the issue around the immigration ban. And he took a very focused approach, made very powerful arguments here and elsewhere in Washington. And I think we really need to acknowledge and celebrate the fact that we've had such a breakthrough with the PEPFAR reauthorization, and that Craig deserves an enormous amount of credit for that. So thank you, Craig, and thank you for being with us. And I'm thrilled that Kevin Fenton has come. The Mexico City was a very dramatic, and we're going to hear more from Craig and more from Kevin and others and from Catherine Bliss about the developments there, which were complex and fast-moving. The domestic issue here, the resurgent epidemic in the United States, the question around data, the question around the drivers, the question around what kind of prevention approach is required and how to do this has really refocused an enormous amount of energy on this issue. And Kevin, we owe you a great debt for the way that you've courageously and very clearly brought this forward, and we'll be hearing that from you here today. And this is a turning point, and it's one that I think brings home the domestic content when we talk about global health, that it is not over there. It's with us. It's a universal, and it's something that brings that fact home. And Catherine Bliss is a new addition to CSIS as Deputy Director of the Americas Program, brings remarkable expertise on Mexico, on public health, and we're thrilled to have her here. Today we are issuing a short report. She'll be summarizing for you. We're issuing that today in hard copy as well as on the website, as I understand it. So thank you all for being here, and thank you, Jennifer, for all your work. And Jennifer will be moderating and directing the choreography here for us. Thank you.
I'm choreographer for today. Welcome to everyone. I'll echo Steve's welcome on behalf of Kaiser Family Foundation and CSIS. This is a great turnout. When we first started doing this a few years ago, we didn't know if anyone would show up. We thought either people went to the conference and don't need to come and reflect, or maybe they wouldn't be interested. And actually every other year when we do this, we get quite a turnout. And it just reminds us that not only are these conferences such an important moment for us to all think about where we are in combating HIV, but there's a lot of opportunity to take the time between the conference ending and now, reflect on it, bring people together to try to think forward. I mean, that's the point of today, is really not so much to only rehash what happened, but really use that to think forward about where we are, what can we expect, what are some of the key things on the agenda. Before I get to a little bit more about the flow of today, I just want to also echo the thanks back to CSIS for doing this with Kaiser, and particularly to Steve Morrison and Kate Hoffler and their team for making this happen, which was great for Kaiser because our building was otherwise occupied. So the fact that they made this all happen is great. Alicia Carbow in my office also worked tirelessly to bring the event together, and has a little-known talent that I didn't know too much about, but also produces video. So the video that we'll show today, which is essentially a clips reel from many of the highlights at the conference, to give those of you who were there and probably couldn't attend an iota of what happened, or those who weren't there, a sense of what the key discussion points were. And I really want to echo the thanks for Craig and Kevin, who not only came far. So Craig came from Europe to be here, and having the IAS here is critical, since they oversee and make the conferences happen. And also, as Steve mentioned, IAS has increasingly been involved in policy discussions and really helping to have an international voice across countries on some key issues, and one of them we'll hear a little bit about today on the immigration and travel ban. And then Kevin Fenton from CDC, who not only Atlanta's maybe not that far away, but tomorrow, for those of you who don't know, there's a big hearing on the Hill on the whole, prompted by the release of the data that Kevin's going to talk about. So he and his staff and everyone at CDC is very, very busy preparing for that, and thank you for taking the time to talk to this group today. And then, of course, to Catherine and Steve, and I'll say a little bit more about what everyone's going to focus on. And one other thing I want to emphasize about the importance of having Kevin here, for those of us who straddle both worlds, who sometimes think that we're forced to think about domestic HIV as separate from global HIV, which doesn't really make sense, this was really a change in how the domestic epidemic, how the understanding, I think, globally of our epidemic here at home was seen by the rest of the world, for better or for worse. But I think more attention is always a good thing. It is a turning point, and to capitalize on what that means for the United States and the global response, because the United States situation is probably not that different from a lot of other, some of the countries in Europe, et cetera. So we're just really excited that we could bring together some of the key themes that we saw at the conference. I will say a little bit about each of our speakers. The flow is this. We will show you the video clips. And I should mention, this event is being webcast, and all of the plenaries and many of the other sessions were webcast by Kaiser Network, and so those are all available, will always be available forever. You can also go look at the transcripts from many of the sessions. In addition to the sessions that were webcast, there were several interviews done with people involved at the conference. So it's a great way to get a sense of the things that got said or discussed. Even if you were there, there's just no way to take it all in. So we'll show that first. Then Craig's going to speak first and give us a perspective from IAS's viewpoint. How did the conference go? This was the 17th conference. It was the first one in Latin America, so it was an important in and of itself. But it's also, we think, a turning point in terms of thinking about future conferences. So hearing from Craig will be great on that front. And then Kevin, who will talk, as we mentioned, about the CDC's new data and what it means for the U.S. and just placing that within a larger context. And CDC just this last week released some newer analyses, some subpopulation analyses of those data. So we have even more information that we're all digesting still. Then we'll hear from Catherine Bliss from CSIS, and she's a Latin Americanist, so she'll be able to tell us what this means. Why is it important to have conferences in different parts of the world where there haven't been conferences like this. What does it do to bring that many people and focus on HIV to Mexico? So we'll hear about that. And then Steve will wrap up with some concluding comments, and then we'll just turn to your questions so we can have an interaction about where we are and try to share information that we may all, some of us might be involved in some of these ongoing conversations. So we look forward to your comments. Okay, I will start the video, and then we'll go to our speakers.
Conference. The 2008 International AIDS Conference, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
It has always been the role of the International AIDS Conference to challenge our governments and our leaders to meet their moral and political obligations. And it will happen again here in Mexico City, where we are demanding universal action now.
For the first time, fewer people are dying of AIDS, and for the first time, fewer people are becoming infected with HIV. For the first time, we have empirical evidence that our brilliant coalition can move mountains.
I call on all countries to live up to their commitment to enact or enforce legislation outlawing discrimination against the people living with HIV and members of vulnerable groups.
In this region, where men who have sex with men continue to bear the brunt of the epidemic, that means challenging homophobia everywhere, in our society, in government policies, in healthcare settings, in our families, and yes, in our churches as well.
We should not accept that less than 10% of individuals at high risk for HIV, like sex workers, IDU, MSM, and prisoners in developing countries, are receiving appropriate prevention interventions. We should not accept that PMTCT, a proven effective preventive technology, is not the highest of global and national priorities to reduce HIV transmission to children to below 2%. We should not accept that we cannot provide HIV testing routinely to all who need it.
She'd received decent medical care, loving care, decent nutrition, and treatment. That's the same child.
At age 18, we are considered apt by governments for being sent to battle to protect our country. But when it comes to protecting ourselves, the funding and support for our right to access evidence-based and comprehensive services that also promote condom use and contraceptives as a means of safe sex is often denied, especially to those most at risk.
In all cases in which national HIV epidemics have been reversed, broad-based behavior change was central to that success. Yet despite this strong evidence, many have been skeptical about the effectiveness of behavioral HIV prevention programs. This concern is clearly misplaced, and we shouldn't confuse the difficulty in changing human behavior with the inability to do it.
I believe that the future for AIDS research indeed looks bright and promising. The history of AIDS research is one, quite frankly, of breathtaking accomplishments. However, here we are gathered in Mexico City, still in the middle of a raging pandemic. To be sure, there are multiple and daunting challenges ahead in how we confront HIV globally. Not all, but certainly some of these challenges can only be addressed through biomedical research.
Prevention, treatment, and care for children continue to lag behind adults. Support for affected children has been left largely to families, extended kin, and communities. Although they are the most appropriate groups to help children, they cannot protect and care for children without assistance.
ART Scale-Up is a health system success. It's the most ambitious public health undertaking of my lifetime, and it was something that was done against the conventional wisdom of the time.
People living with HIV have played roles and contributed immensely to healthcare systems. We are not just patients, we are not just receivers of services, but really we are the leaders when it comes to delivery in as regards HIV and AIDS, because we have taught ourselves, we have taught our communities, we have raised our voices, we have helped people understand what's happening.
The lesson could not be more urgent. When the world denies women their most basic human rights, the world is vulnerable to HIV.
The key word emerging from this conference is combination. Combination prevention strategies tailored to decrease HIV transmission. Combination antiretroviral therapy to dramatically reduce morbidity and mortality among those infected worldwide. Combination antiretroviral therapy to also reduce community viral load as an aid to prevention. Combination strategies to enhance HIV testing. Combination strategies to reduce poverty, homelessness, and discrimination.
We now look forward to the final removal of HIV from the list of communicable diseases that ban visitors' entry to the U.S. It is an enormous victory for USA and international advocates.
Having more than 56,000 new HIV infections occurring each year in the United States is not acceptable. And we as a society need to think about what we all need to be doing at the individual level, in communities, and as a society to bring this epidemic to an end within our lifetimes.
We need a domestic AIDS response that is oriented around achieving clear and ambitious objectives in terms of reducing HIV infection rates, increasing access to care, and reducing racial and ethnic health disparities.
African Americans named AIDS as the number one health problem in America, but only one in two say the United States is not losing ground. The other half say we are in the domestic AIDS epidemic. For Americans, this should be a wake-up call. Even as we keep working globally, we need to do much more to fight AIDS at home. And I intend to do so with my foundation.
We have pushed the agenda in Mexico, Latin America, and the world towards sex education, lower drug prices, and human rights. And we should not stop pushing. Goodbye to all. Adios a todos. See you in Vienna. Nos vemos en Vienna. Muchas gracias a todos.
The 2008 International AIDS Conference, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Well, that brought back a lot of recent memories. First of all, I just want to thank Steve Morrison and the CSIS team, as well as Jen Cates and the Kaiser team for inviting me today. I'm really pleased to be here today, especially with Kevin and with Catherine. Mexico, I think, just from a personal perspective, was really quite an extraordinary international AIDS conference. It was the first time that the meeting was held in Latin America. The fact that it was held in Mexico City, which is really such a city with such a vibrant history of political activism that continues to this day. The fact that there was so much political leadership at this conference, contrasted with the last international conference held in my home city of Toronto, which shamefully did not include the Prime Minister of Canada, which sent a signal to other political leaders around the world who also did not attend. In Mexico, President Calderon opened the meeting. As you saw, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was also part of the opening. The Premier Vice President of Spain was there. A whole range of political leadership from around the world. And I think Mexico was a success both from the perspective of the political leadership there, the perspective of the community engagement in the conference, and from the perspective of science and implementation of evidence. What I'm going to do over the next 14 minutes, and I do have a tendency to talk too much, so I'm going to watch the clock. What I'm going to do over the next 14 minutes, just checking when, okay, is give a quick overview of Mexico in terms of the outcomes of the conference, some statistics, but also some of the outcomes, the preliminary impact that we've seen both in Mexico itself, across the Latin America region and Caribbean, and globally. Then I'm going to switch gears for a little bit and talk about entry, stay, and residence restrictions on people living with HIV here in the U.S. and also throughout the world. I'm going to briefly talk about the potential for the IIS to host an international conference in the United States in the future, and then just tell you a little bit quickly about what we anticipate in terms of 2010 Vienna, what we are working to achieve in Vienna, and why the conference is being held in Vienna. So, that being said, a few statistics on the Mexico City Conference. It was the second largest conference in the history of the International AIDS Conference in terms of the number of people who participated. Just slightly fewer people than Toronto 2 years ago, which was the largest conference, 26,000 people. In Mexico City, we had 24,000 rather. As you can see, about 40% of them from Latin America and the Caribbean, 12% from Africa, 10% from Europe, about 16% from Asia, and 24% from North America. About 800 people were offered scholarships from around the world, close to half of them from the Latin American Caribbean region. Over 2,000 journalists. The International AIDS Conference has consistently been the most covered event in terms of the media in HIV and AIDS. And over half of the people that attended Mexico were attending for the first time, which I think is significant because a lot of us who've been working in HIV for a long time tend to think that it's a meeting where we sort of reconnect with old friends and say the same things over and over again, hope that those messages will be heard. And yet, 12,000 of the 24,000 people who attended had never been before. And I had the opportunity to speak with a number of them when I got a moment in the halls. And you really could see in their eyes, in their faces, the kind of expression of, wow, I'm part of this incredible global movement to end this epidemic. And the kind of energy that the conference gives them when they go back to their work, I think, is pretty extraordinary. I think this conference was probably the most focused in terms of the messages we were trying to drive home. When I say we, I mean the IIS and the international and local partners who planned the international conference. IIS is the lead partner and the implementer of the decisions of the various committees planning the conference. But the partners involved include UN partners, international community and scientific partners, as well as local partners in the host country from science, community, and political leadership. And we really had a few focused messages that we wanted to drive home, and then there were a number of others that emerged sort of organically over the 5 days of the conference. I think the first and most, one of the most important messages we wanted to get across was the critical need for treatment and prevention to come together. People have talked about that for many years. But I think in Mexico, we really began to see, to quote Myron Cohen, who gave the plenary on prevention technologies, we were beginning to see finally a marriage between the two. A lot of people said, oh, there was no new science at Mexico. But in fact, I think those people didn't realize the subtle but significant shifts that have happened in this past year around guidelines for treatment and the potential impact of treatment on prevention. First of all, the IAS USA, which is an independent organization, it's not a part of the IAS per se, Paul Volberding's group based here in the U.S., whose primary program, if you like, is the development of regular guidelines on when to initiate antiretroviral therapy, how to initiate antiretroviral therapy, and what drugs to use. The guidelines have shifted. They came out just before the Mexico conference, and the pendulum is shifting back to treating much earlier, and I think that pendulum will stay there. Why? Because we now know clearly that HIV is a chronic inflammatory disease that damages the major organs of the body from the beginning of infection, long before the immune system begins to deteriorate. HIV itself causes chronic inflammation in the body that puts pressure on the heart, on the kidneys, on the liver, and we know that people who deferred therapy till later, or people who have been on large trials where they go on therapy and then have drug holidays, then go back on therapy, do much worse than people who start earlier. Personally, I think we are at the beginning of a shift that ultimately will lead to treatment on diagnosis for people who are ready and for people who have access. And that means testing people much more regularly than we do now, having in place national legislation to protect against human rights abuses against people living with HIV, to protect against discrimination, having mechanisms in place to enforce those protections, and then making treatment a part of routine health care wherever people live throughout the world, and treating them upon diagnosis. I think that is a major shift, something that has major implications globally in terms of access. We have commitments from all member states of the United Nations from 2006 at the UNGAS review meeting following the 2005 G8 commitments to provide treatment, prevention, support, and care to everyone who needs it throughout the world. Who needs it? Everyone who has HIV. Who needs treatment? Everyone who has HIV. Furthermore, we know much more clearly now that when you drive viral load down in an individual, you virtually eliminate the potential for transmission. If we can drive community viral load down across populations, we will see a dramatic impact on HIV transmission, a reduction in HIV transmission. Why is that so controversial? We already use treatment to prevent HIV infection. We use it in pregnant women. We use it in health workers who've been exposed to HIV. We use it in people who've been exposed to HIV sexually or through drug use. And it looks like we will use it as a pre-exposure prophylaxis if the trials pan out as we expect, if the trials are successful as we are likely to see in the next year. So why is it so controversial when, one, we already have a global commitment to treat everybody everywhere anyway? Why is it controversial to talk about using treatment to prevent HIV? I have no answer for that, and I think that we need to continue to pressure our leaders to accept that fact and to move on. The second key message we were trying to get across was to end this debate about health systems versus an HIV response, or an HIV response somehow damaging health systems, particularly in resource-limited countries. I think that debate hopefully is over now. What was quite clear coming out of the conference from a number of major reports, including the Global Fund, is that the expansion of HIV services in developing countries is contributing to strengthening health systems. But yes, we need to focus much more on that in the future. We need to integrate HIV services with sexual and reproductive health care, with primary health care, with maternal health care, with TB health care, with health care across the board. HIV has got to become less of a specialized area and much more a part of routine care in the health sector. But significant monies have been spent in the last few years since finally we acquired major resources for AIDS to build new laboratories, to build new clinics, to train new health workers. We need to keep our eye on that on that goal in the future of strengthening health systems through the HIV response, but we need to absolutely stop this debate that somehow we are damaging health systems, which are so weak to begin with anyway, in developing countries through expanding HIV services. The third key message, I think, was about concentrated epidemics and human rights, that in most parts of the world outside of sub-Saharan Africa, HIV is concentrated in three primary at-risk communities: gay men and men who have sex, other men who have sex with men, sex workers, and injecting drug users. There are other communities affected, but those are the three most at-risk communities throughout the world. And in one region or another, one country or another, it's more injecting drug users, or it's more gay men, or sex workers are more affected. But it's clear that for most of the world, we are talking about targeting the need to target our HIV response to those most at-risk communities. And even in sub-Saharan Africa, data is clear that amongst those three communities, prevalence is even higher. Even MSM, where we knew very little about MSM in Africa until recently, and we still, quite frankly, know very little, HIV prevalence in sub-Saharan Africa, in the countries where we have data, is higher than in the general population. The disgrace, of course, is that only 44% of countries reporting on their UNGAS targets, as they are expected to do in their 2007 reports, said anything about gay men and men who have sex with men in their countries. Most of the reports said data unavailable. In fact, I just came from Buenos Aires, where I gave a presentation on MSM in developing countries, and the title of the presentation was Data Unavailable. It's quite extraordinarily poor. Even UNAIDS admits that out of its 2007 analysis released in Mexico, that fewer than 1 in 20 men who have sex with men throughout the world has access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. Quite a disgrace when the epidemic really emerged in our communities in the early years in North America, Europe, and Australia. Now, obviously, in addition to those key messages that we were really trying to push, a lot emerged organically at the conference. New data on the U.S. epidemic, Kevin will talk about that. Quite extraordinary activism from groups campaigning for housing for people living with HIV, and some very feisty activism indeed from sex workers, particularly the competing sex worker rights groups in Mexico, who clearly don't get along with each other very well. So I want to kind of move on now. Something new that happened at the conference in Mexico was a series of regional sessions that the IAS put on with leading scientists and advocates from each region, with the intention of linking what happened in those regional sessions to regional conferences that are happening later this year and earlier next year. A major attempt to really connect global information back to the regional context, and then at the regional regional conferences to do the reverse, connect the regional evidence back to the global context. Another thing that was new in that regard for Mexico was a series of conference hubs that took place around the world. Over 100 hubs being places where groups of people could congregate and discuss sessions that had particular relevance to their communities. People could select from the vast program of the international conference, all of which this time for the first time was recorded on film and audio, and then engage in those discussions. We had one official hub that we piloted in Durban, South Africa, which actually had a real-time connection to what was going on in Mexico, particularly to the African regional session. So those 300-odd people in Durban could communicate with what was happening in Mexico in real time. I think the hubs, the fact that almost everything's available online now to people throughout the world, means we can have much greater reach. And quite frankly, the conference can't get any bigger physically because there are very few places in the world that can host it. So impact, quickly. What do we know now? In Mexico specifically, announcement by President Calderon that new negotiations would take place with the pharmaceutical companies for reductions in drug prices. Some of those are already complete, and prices are significantly lower. Also, the suspension of a Mexican law, which previously meant that antiretrovirals could only be bought from companies that had a manufacturing facility in Mexico. So now that law is no longer in place, and they have the opportunity to buy and negotiate with a wider range of companies making this similar drugs. Much stronger political commitment from the Mexican government post-conference than previously. And for me, being a big part of the 2 years of planning before the conference is always exciting, because that's where you start to see, well, how is this country engaging as we head towards the conference? And what my experience was the change in government about a year and a half ago initially meant that the new government, while still from the same party, was much more conservative, less engagement than we had in our negotiations 3 years ago. That changed substantially, and by the end of the conference, you saw a really strong commitment from the Mexican government to the response. Regionally, just a couple of concrete bits of information. The education ministers from around Latin America and the Caribbean met the 2 days before the conference. They agreed, all of them, on a sex education, a declaration to provide sex education to 8 to 12-year-olds, comprehensive sex education, throughout the region. That was very controversial, particularly from some of the Caribbean countries participating, but it went through. And the last country in Latin America with criminalizing homosexuality with sodomy laws ended those laws in the days leading up to the conference. That was Panama. So while there are still anti-sodomy laws in some countries in the Caribbean, in Latin America, there are no countries that criminalize homosexuality now. Globally, I talked about the marriage of treatment and prevention. MSM highlighted globally and renewed commitment to address that. Commitment to link health services, HIV services, to strengthened health systems. And then some success, as Peter said. Successes that have been achieved over the past few years. Not enough, but we're really beginning to see finally, after 5 years of significant resources, drops in new infections and increases in treatment access. The 3x5 target, 3 million on treatment by 2005, was met at the end of 2007. Shifting gears very quickly. Most of you know, for 20 years in the U.S., people living with HIV, foreign-born people living with HIV, have been prevented from entering short-term, staying, or residing in the U.S. That's meant that since 1990, the International AIDS Conference, nor any of our meetings, in fact, have been held in the United States. The ban on entry was removed from the Immigration Act within the PEPFAR reauthorization legislation. The end of July, just before the conference, that's major progress. That now needs to be reviewed in terms of policy by HSS. We know that is ongoing now. At least informal commitment is that process will be complete before the end of the year. So we hope that the ban on entry of people living with HIV will be gone forever, finally, at the end of 2008. What does that mean in terms of hosting a conference in the future? Well, it means that we would be able to do so. Our Pathogenesis Scientific Conference takes place next year in Cape Town. The next International AIDS Conference in 2010 is in Vienna. The 2011 Pathogenesis Conference is in Rome. And the Council of the International AIDS Society is now considering where the meeting will be in 2012. The problem, of course, is that we tend to rotate, since Durban 2000, from a developing to a developed country. If 2012 was held in the U.S., it would mean changing that rotation. There's going to be a lively and healthy debate about that amongst my board with input from external partners. But clearly, 2012, 2014, we want to come back to the U.S. That depends on the policy being changed. It depends on the political commitment of different branches of the government here. It depends on a financial commitment as well, because the host countries traditionally, going back the last 10 years or so, have provided between 10 and 20% of the budget, depending whether it's been a developing or developed country, of about a $20 million U.S. conference. Finally, why are we going to Vienna? We wanted to go to Eastern Europe and highlight the epidemic there. The conference has never been in Eastern Europe or Central Asia. There is no city in Central in Eastern Europe that has the capacity, both in terms of the conference venue or hotels, to host the conference there. St. Petersburg and Moscow in Russia could do so, but we weren't prepared to face the political challenges of organizing the conference in Russia for a whole variety of reasons. So Vienna is going to act as a bridge from east to west, as it has as a city historically. Structure of the conference slightly different, international, local, and regional representation. So though it is an international conference, we really want to highlight issues in Eastern Europe, in particular injecting drug use. I'll end there. I know I'm 4 minutes over time, and I apologize. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today, and let me say thanks as well to the organizers, CSIS and Kaiser Family Foundation, for inviting me to do this brief presentation. Now, I have a sort of fortunate role because I'm reprising the presentation which I did in Mexico City, which, as you've heard today, was really a pivoting point for us, both in terms of the awareness that it brought to the domestic HIV epidemic in Mexico City, but also the amount of work that it has generated since we've returned to the United States, as the CDC and our partners have been both releasing more data on the domestic HIV epidemic and increasing the focus on the domestic HIV epidemic. Now, just to add to the reflections of Craig, Mexico City was an incredible time for us, certainly at CDC. It was a time that really followed the reauthorization of PEPFAR. We had the release of the Black AIDS Institute report on HIV in Black America, which was an incredible success, which really highlighted the tremendous disparities which we have in the United States, and particularly the burden of disease found among African Americans. And of course, added to that was the data coming out on the new HIV incidence estimates for the United States. So we really had an amazing confluence, so to speak, of a great focus on the U.S.'s leadership on HIV/AIDS prevention, both internationally, but also what we're doing domestically and ways in which we need to be enhancing our activities as we move forward. So for the next 15 minutes or so, what I'd like to do are these four things. I'd like to reflect on the HIV epidemic in the United States. I'm going to be discussing HIV incidence. I'm going to be presenting some new data, which were released only last week, on subpopulation estimates from our HIV incidence surveillance activities. And then I'm going to reflect on HIV prevention, the implications for domestic prevention in the United States. And I'm going to end with a brief summary. This is really a timely presentation. As you've heard, tomorrow we're going to be, hopefully Dr. Gerberding and myself will be at a hearing with Congressman Waxman. And this will be a chance for us to reflect upon some of the successes, some of the challenges with the domestic HIV epidemic. So let's just reflect upon the new HIV incidence data on HIV in the United States. Now, as many of you in the room are aware, CDC had released earlier estimates of HIV incidence, which were based on indirect methods, methods which were less sophisticated than we used in the recent analysis this year. In 87 to 1992, the estimate at that time was between 40 to 80,000 Americans who were newly infected with HIV.
And in 2001, another publication by CDC suggested that there were approximately 40,000 new HIV infections which occurred at that time. Now, what has happened since that time, since the beginning of the 2000s, is that we've been able to use both developments with new surveillance systems, new diagnostic technologies for HIV, and new testing approaches for HIV. And we've been able to combine these new approaches to get a more clear picture on the evolution of HIV in the United States. The approach that we're using is the STARS assay, which distinguishes recent from long-standing infections. And we're able to apply this in a sentinel surveillance system in the U.S., looking at 22 states across the country. So in other words, this is not a comprehensive HIV incident surveillance system. We have looked at a specific set of jurisdictions and then calculated the estimates for the United States as a whole. Now, because it was equally important to understand both the point estimate of incidence as well as how incidence has changed over time, we also reported in the publication in JAMA the results of our extended back calculation approach. And this is looking at the data that we have on HIV diagnoses and AIDS diagnoses in the United States and working backwards in time to impute when new infections of HIV were likely to occur. So in other words, we were able to look between 1977 to 2006 to plot the trends in HIV incidence in the United States. So I'm going to be presenting these data, and we're going to be going through them in a little bit more detail. So this was the headline from Mexico City as far as the domestic HIV epidemic is concerned. In 2006, approximately 56,300 Americans were infected with HIV. And this was clearly substantially higher than had been known to have been occurring in the United States. However, as you will see in subsequent slides, the trends in HIV incidence have remained unchanged since the late 1990s. Now, in terms of the gender distribution of the new HIV infections, the majority of the new infections are occurring among men, approximately 73%, and 27% occurred among women. And this slide just shows both the overall trends in HIV incidence as well as the distribution by age over time. And I'll walk you through the slide because once you are oriented to this slide, it will be a lot easier to understand the ones that will follow. So in green, we have the overall trends in HIV incidence. We see a peak in HIV incidence in the mid-1980s. At that time, HIV incidence was estimated to be occurring at approximately 130,000 new infections in the United States. You see a decline which occurred in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, a step up in the late 1990s, and the relative stabilization in HIV incidence since the late 1990s. The pattern among males really follows very closely the overall patterns of HIV incidence in the U.S. population, in part because males account for the majority of new HIV infections, peaks in the mid-1980s, declines subsequently, and relative stabilization since the late 1990s. Among women, we saw a slightly later peak of HIV incidence, which occurred in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and we've seen a slight but sustained decline in HIV incidence in women since that time. When we look at transmission categories for new HIV infections for 2006, quite unsurprisingly, we see that the majority of new infections are occurring among men who sex with men. Approximately 53% of the 56,300 infections in 2006 were among men who sex with men. About a third were among individuals who are exposed through heterosexual intercourse, 12%, nearly 1 in 10, through injecting drug use, and about 4% among men who sex with men who also inject drugs. And again, if we look at some of the trends over time, I'm again going to be walking through this slide to just show you some of the key features of how HIV incidence has changed over time. So the first line I'd like to draw your attention to is the blue line, which shows the trends among men who sex with men. Again, we saw this tremendous peak occurring at about 75,000 to 80,000 new HIV infections in the mid-1980s, tremendous declines occurring since then. And since the early 1990s, we've seen gradual and sustained increases in HIV incidence among men who've sex with men. And in fact, MSM are the only group where we have seen sustained increases in HIV incidence since the early 1990s. Among injecting drug users, we saw two peaks which occurred, one in the mid-1980s, another in the early 1990s, but we have seen tremendous declines in HIV incidence among injecting drug users since that time. Similarly, a slightly later peak among heterosexuals, but we have been seeing declines in HIV incidence since the mid-1990s. And among MSM who inject drug, we've been seeing declines as well. The third sort of look at the HIV incidence data that I'd like to present today are the distributions by race ethnicity. So we have seen the distribution by gender. We have seen it by transmission category. Now, by race ethnicity, we see that nearly 45% of the new HIV infections in 2006 occurred among blacks in the United States. And this is despite the fact that blacks account for approximately 12% of the U.S. population. Hispanics account for approximately 15% of the U.S. population, yet in 2006, 17% of new HIV infections were in this group, and whites about 35%, and much smaller proportions for other ethnic groups in the United States. Again, this is the final sort of back calculation chart I'll show, and this is really just to show the distribution over time by the various racial and ethnic groups. And again, unsurprisingly, among whites, we saw the peaks in the mid-1980s, in part because at that stage, most of the new infections were occurring among white gay men. So the pattern is very similar to what we've seen for gay men in general, with subsequent declines and some increases throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. Among blacks, we saw a slightly later peak, which occurred in the early 1990s. We have been seeing some declines over time, but more importantly, we've seen relative stabilization in the HIV incidence among blacks in the United States. And then finally, among Hispanics, we saw various peaks occurring in the mid-1980s, in the early 1990s, again, a step up in the mid-1990s, but some evidence of a stabilization or decline in HIV incidence among Hispanics using the back calculation approach. In this slide, I'm looking specifically at American Indians and Alaskan and Asian Pacific Islanders, and we've taken a different scale on the slide, in part because when we compare these ethnic groups with the other ethnic groups, we often tend to see a very flat line. But if we look at the data for the Asian Pacific Islanders, we have been seeing both peaks in the mid-1990s and some increases more recently. And among American Indians and Alaska Natives, peaks again in the mid to late 1980s and relative stabilization since then, although there have been some increases in the 2000s. The final cut of the HIV incidence data I'm going to be presenting is that by age. And what was really interesting and perhaps distressing in the data were the proportion of new infections which were occurring among young people in the United States. And here, these data suggest that nearly a third, about 34%, of new HIV infections in 2006 occurred in young adults under 30 years of age, between 13 to 29. Now, we know from other HIV surveillance data that the majority of these new infections are going to be in the 20 to 29-year-old age group. But still, this is looking at a third of new infections occurring at that time. About a third occurring in the age group between 30 and 39, and about another third occurring in individuals aged 40 and older. So, since that time, CDC colleagues returned from Mexico City, and there was tremendous interest in the data, but also tremendous interest in the implications of the data for HIV prevention in the United States. One of the key promises we made in Mexico City was that we were going to really accelerate our efforts to look at subpopulation estimates of HIV incidence, so we were able to get better granularity at who among the ethnic minorities or who among gay and bisexual men are at greatest risk of HIV new infections in the United States. So in the next three or four slides, what I'd like to do is just to show and to highlight some data from the recent MMWR, which was published last week. And I hope that many of you in the room have had a chance to review the data from this publication. So the first is just looking at the distribution by gender and by race ethnicity. So if we look at men for new infections in the U.S., approximately 40% of the new infections among men in 2006 were occurring among black men, about 41% among whites, and 19% among Hispanics. And among women, we see the severe and disproportionate burden of HIV, which is occurring among black women in the United States. About nearly two-thirds, about 61% of new HIV infections were among black women, 16% among Hispanic women, and about a quarter among white women. In this slide, we look at the population rates for HIV incidence. So we adjust these numbers of new infections based upon the population. And again, these data are perhaps not surprising given what we know from our AIDS diagnoses and HIV diagnoses data, but they're still a stark reminder of the tremendous racial and ethnic disparities that we see, not only for HIV diagnoses, but also for new HIV infections in the United States. So if you look at men, we see the tremendous burden of HIV incidence, which is seen among black men in the United States. This is nearly about 5 to 7 times that greater than whites, and about 4 times greater than what is seen among Hispanics. And we see these tremendous differences among females as well, where the rates, incidence rates for black women is 55.7 per 100,000, substantially higher than for white women at about 4 per 100,000. What was also interesting in the data that we released last week was our ability to look at race, ethnicity, especially among men who have sex with men in the United States, and to further break these data down by age group. And again, in this slide, we're looking at white gay men, black gay men, and Hispanic gay men. And we're also looking at where HIV incidence occurs, where the distribution of HIV incidence in these racial and ethnic groups among men who have sex with men. So if we focus on black MSM to begin with in the middle, we see that the majority of new HIV infections which occurred in 2006 were actually occurring in young black gay men. Nearly half of the new infections were among young MSM aged 13 to 29, about a quarter in black MSM aged 30 to 39, and the rest in older black MSM. And this pattern was quite similar for Hispanics as well, where we saw the majority of new HIV infections occurring among younger Hispanic men who sex with men, although the proportion of new diagnoses which were occurring in the younger age group was substantially less than what we observed for black men who sex with men. Among white MSM, we saw a very different pattern, where the peak age group for HIV incidence was actually in an older group of MSM, for white MSM. Nearly a third of new HIV infections among white MSM were occurring in the 30 to 39-year-old age group, approximately a quarter among young MSM aged under 30 years, and the rest occurring in individuals aged 40 years and over. So in the final few minutes of the presentation, I'd just like to reflect on what are we taking away from these data as far as the implications for prevention are concerned. I think there are some challenges, a number of challenges which we have ahead of us as we think about accelerating our prevention efforts in the United States. We know from other data that more than a quarter of individuals living with HIV in the United States remain undiagnosed. We know that from these data and certainly other surveillance data that MSM remain at increased risk of acquiring HIV and indeed transmitting HIV, and new infections are increasing. Again, MSM are the only group where we've seen consistent increases in HIV incidence since the early 1990s. The data are clear that African Americans and Hispanics bear the heaviest burden of disease in the United States, and we have tremendous concerns about limited access to effective prevention interventions and the need to really look at opportunities to enhance and to meet the unmet need in the population. There's also concern about the availability of effective treatments have led to complacency about HIV risk, not only among men who have sex with men, but indeed other groups and other populations within the subpopulations within the US. There are other key challenges that we're grappling with as well. HIV/AIDS stigma still persists and, in fact, is a key impediment both to accessing effective care, to accessing HIV testing services, and indeed to ensuring that people who are living with HIV live long, healthy, productive, and supported lives. We see changing patterns in the distribution of substance abuse in the United States, and one of the big concerns we currently have are the epidemics of crystal meth, which are ravaging parts of the United States and indeed disproportionately affecting, especially affecting men who have sex with men and their risk behaviors. We know that the internet has emerged as a major focus for meeting new sexual partners, but it also has emerged as a tremendous opportunity for enhancing our prevention interventions. So here we have both a tremendous challenge, but also a tremendous opportunity as well. We know that there's a need for more culturally competent interventions, especially as the epidemic is evolving to affect more people of color, young MSM, especially Hispanic and African-American MSM, and we need to ensure that the tools that we have in our prevention toolkit are indeed meeting the needs of these populations.
And then finally, there are structural factors, whether poverty, homelessness, racism, and homophobia. And at the Mexico conference, there were clear messages which were received regarding the need for us to move upstream in tackling these factors if we are to have a comprehensive HIV prevention approach. In the final two slides, I'm just going to speak about CDC's response, and I'd be happy to follow up on this in the discussion. CDC has really been focusing on a number of key areas moving forward, and this response really predated the availability of the new HIV incidence estimates. We have been expanding our HIV testing investments, as well as partnering with our partners at state, local, and community-based organizations to enhance HIV testing activities. We're expanding access to effective behavioral intervention and prevention programs, and we're mobilizing at-risk communities, whether we're developing new interventions with the African-American community, with the Latino community, and we're also now looking at our efforts to strengthen our relationship and mobilization with MSM communities in the United States. Part of what we need to do as well, and which we have begun doing, is reassessing our efforts for prevention with men who sex with men and other hardest hit communities in the United States. And we will continue to invest in research on new interventions to add to the prevention toolkit. One of the things that really came out to us at the Mexico conference were calls for a national HIV plan. And CDC is certainly supportive of calls for a comprehensive national HIV plan. And certainly, as we think about providing global leadership on HIV, and we're working with so many countries internationally, and one of the stipulations of doing this work internationally is ensuring that there are comprehensive and joined-up approaches to HIV prevention, we certainly feel that such an approach is certainly worthwhile and needed in the United States. We're committed to having a critical review of our HIV prevention portfolio, and we'll be doing that later this year, and we're hoping to complete this by early 2009. And we'll be inviting an independent panel of national and international experts to assess what we're doing at CDC and to look at ways in which we can continue to enhance the use of the prevention resources. And finally, we're working on a new strategic roadmap for HIV prevention with measurable objectives to 2020. So this brings me to the end of my presentation. I think what I wanted to leave with you today are these few points, that HIV/AIDS continues to evolve in the United States, and it really is, we now have perhaps the clearest picture that we've ever had on the domestic epidemic of the disproportionate burden which is being borne among men who sex with men, African Americans, and Hispanics. There are tremendous challenges which are ahead of us as we move forward with prevention, but I believe there are tremendous opportunities as well. And part of that opportunity is looking at renewing our commitment to accelerating our efforts for HIV prevention, renewing our commitment to mobilizing communities, and renewing our commitment to having a new, open, and honest dialogue on where we are with HIV in the United States and where we need to be. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me just, since I'm referring to Latin America and the Caribbean, let me just start with some brief statistics, since not everybody in here may focus on the region. The 2008 UN AIDS estimates suggest that there are about 1.9 million people infected with HIV/AIDS in Latin America and the Caribbean. According to the same data, the year 2007 saw 140,000 new infections and 63,000 AIDS-related deaths. Prevalence rates in Latin America and the Caribbean, which range from 0.1% to 3%, are generally considered to be low compared with other parts of the world. But experts point to the diversity of epidemics that characterize the region's experience. In some countries, the overall prevalence may be low, but HIV infections are concentrated among men who have sex with men, commercial sex workers, or injecting drug users. Elsewhere, there is a tendency toward generalization, including within indigenous communities in some areas, urban slums, or zones characterized by frequent migration. Now, broadly speaking, there has been a trend toward greater willingness on the part of regional political leaders to take bold steps to address the epidemic. The very early years of AIDS saw assertions that HIV was a U.S. or European phenomenon that just could not happen in Latin America. There were also, in some places, cultural struggles over AIDS, sexuality, and morality. but it's now clear that a part of the world that boasts a long and distinguished history of intergovernmental cooperation on health has made valuable contributions to scientific research on HIV/AIDS and to the development of legal and policy options for addressing the epidemic. So let me quickly identify what I see as a few firsts or novelties from the perspective of the Mexico City Conference before discussing what I see as some of the implications of the conference for the region. Now, as we've heard, AIDS 2008 was the first time the International AIDS Conference was held in Latin America and the Caribbean. Holding the meeting in Mexico enabled, and the number I had was about 6,000, but I think based on the statistics that Craig presented, it sounds like nearly 10,000 people from the region to attend, more than had attended previous sessions, certainly. Health and education ministers from the region took advantage of the conference setting to meet together for the first time to discuss sexual education and HIV/AIDS. The presentation by Elena Reynaga, the founder and executive director of the Argentine Association of Female Sex Workers, marked the first time a representative of the sex work community addressed the plenary at the International AIDS Conference. And at least 5,000 activists from all over the world staged the first international march against stigma, discrimination, and homophobia the weekend before the conference in order to raise awareness of how discriminatory policies and social prejudice hinder efforts to address the HIV/AIDS epidemic. So how did having the meeting in Latin America and the Caribbean shape the conference and its outcomes? First, it seems that leadership from the region played a key role in raising the region's profile with respect to HIV/AIDS. Conference co-chairs Pedro Can from Argentina and Luis Soto Ramirez from Mexico saw the conference as an opportunity to remind donors that Latin America and the Caribbean should not be excluded from the global agenda. They made a special effort to encourage regionally based scientists, advocates, and policymakers to go to Mexico and present their work. Second, during the session and during the opening session, Mexican President Felipe Calderón announced that foreign drug companies would no longer be required to maintain a production facility in Mexico to sell products, including antiretroviral drugs. Now, critics had long complained that the policy essentially protected Mexico's pharmaceutical industry from competition and made drugs more costly in Mexico than in other countries. And advocates who were pleased by the announcement noted that it will now be easier for Mexico to provide antiretroviral drugs through popular insurance schemes, and they suggested that the measure may serve as a model for other kinds of programs. Now, third, plenary sessions featuring Latin American officials and researchers drew attention to the region's contributions to major policy initiatives. In his plenary address on Monday, Dr. Jaime Sepúlveda, founder of Mexico's National AIDS Commission, CONACIDA, urged increased funding, improved program evaluation, and harmonization of international efforts to halt the epidemic's spread. Dr. Jorge Saavedra, head of Mexico's Centro Nacional para la Prevención del VIH-Sida, or CEN-Sida, devoted time during his plenary talk to decrying policies that criminalize homosexuality and marginalize men who have sex with men within HIV/AIDS outreach programs. Conference sessions on the state of the epidemic in Latin America and the Caribbean underscored the challenges of HIV prevention, care, and treatment in a region where an estimated 125 million out of 516 million people do not have regular access to health services. Panelists described the emerging epidemic among international migrants, including those from Mexico to the U.S., and those who transit Mexico on the way to the United States, questioning how the migration process shapes expectations of sexual behavior and beliefs about disease risk. Others focused on the spread of HIV/AIDS within indigenous communities in the region and emphasized the importance of culturally relevant health services. So how can we think about how the conference influenced Latin America and the Caribbean, kind of taking the other side of the question? For one thing, I think the meeting location and the number of presentations focused on the Americas helped spark dialogue among policymakers. For the first time, regional ministers of health and education met to discuss sexual education and HIV/AIDS, adopting the goal of reducing by 75% by the year 2015 the number of schools that do not provide a complete sexual education to students. The Coalition of First Ladies and Female Leaders of Latin America on Women and AIDS met to address the feminization of the epidemic, promoting policies to help the more than 500,000 HIV-infected women in the region. The meetings also stimulated considerable participation among by regional youth. And anyone who attended the meeting noticed the legions of young people volunteering, managing booths in the Global Village, and speaking at sessions. The International AIDS Society and the International Center for Research on Women awarded Mexican researcher Paola Pérez Maldonado the Young Investigator Prize. Honduran teen Karen Denway Gonzalez offered the youth message the opening night. And Monday's plenary featured Elizabeth Ferdul of the Global Youth Partners in the Dominican Republic. So what does all of this mean? First, I think the meeting raised delegates' awareness and policymakers' awareness of the epidemic in Latin America and the Caribbean. Second, extensive media coverage helped make HIV/AIDS a topic of daily discussion in taxis, markets, cafes, and homes, certainly in Mexico City and I think wherever the media coverage reached. Ideally, information exchange and greater awareness will then translate into more funding. And one welcome trend is that the 2007 Global Fund policy changes make upper-middle-income countries with either 1% general prevalence or 5% prevalence among concentrated groups, and this includes several countries in Latin America, making them eligible for grants. So overall, I think the Mexico City meeting attracted high-level participation from leaders in Latin America and the Caribbean, generated considerable regional attendance, and provoked generous media attention. Its proximity and coverage stimulated interest in HIV among regional populations well beyond the official delegates and the policymakers. And I think, moreover, the meetings underscored the importance of continued work to ensure that vulnerable populations in the region are not dissuaded from seeking HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment services, whether because of stigma and discrimination, ignorance of the epidemic, or inability to access health services themselves. So, thank you.
Steve, did you want to?
Yeah. Sure. Just a few quick comments. I'll turn to the audience. I want to remind people the Economist did a really excellent summation, I think, of the wrap up press commentaries. It was far and away the best. I think that IAS, the Mexican government, deserve a lot of commendation, plaudits for the way this was organized. I thought it was really quite exceptional. There was a shift. There seemed to be a shift towards a much more positive view among the participants of the U.S. government, as compared with Toronto and the previous and the Barcelona certainly or Bangkok. There was a certain amount of awe and admiration around the PEPFAR reauthorization, which kept coming up over and over and over again. From quarters that kind of surprised me, and I thought it was encouraging. It seemed that some of the reflexive animosity or antagonism towards the U.S. government had subsided, and there was a much more open discussion. There's quite a bit of pessimism around the science and research, and a lot of soul searching, and a lot of efforts of saying, you know, strategies for back to basics and strategies for trying to shore up optimism by reminding people of the need for oftentimes discoveries to come out of periods of great frustration or short-term failure. And that seemed to also signal some kind of indeterminate reassessment of what the timelines are going to look like in getting new technologies that are safe and have been through the process. The absence of African leadership was striking at a senior state level. I realized this was quite a distance, but it was notable that the big names still remained predominantly northern, and we're at the edge of significant change of leadership, in a sense that Peter Piot will be stepping down. President Mahai has stepped down. He was there. He delivered a terrific speech. He formed the Champions Group, whose mission is, as I gather, to really try to leverage higher activism by African leadership and others. But he's no longer in office. Of course, there's going to be a change of administration here in Washington that will have all sorts of consequences in terms of leadership at both the White House level, but also at the direction of OGAC. Last comment. There was a lot of discussion around combined approaches on prevention. I thought some of the events like what Helene was involved with, the presentation of the working group findings and others, was quite stimulating. But there also seem to be largely a most presentations, outside of those very focused efforts, and the very dramatic presentation of the U.S. data that Kevin was involved with, it seemed to be largely a kind of rhetorical discussion around prevention. There didn't seem to be much much acknowledgement of the degree to which in Eastern and Southern Africa prevention efforts are still remote at a remote distance from effectiveness. And I think that remains one of the key vulnerabilities in the global response, and certainly the key vulnerabilities back here in the United States in sustaining support at these rather prodigious efforts of funding. There's a tendency to sort of make a rhetorical provision and then move on to a discussion around treatment. This is an interesting gathering, the IAS meeting, because it's both a social movement and it's a trade fair. In other words, it's people who are practitioners who have begun to manage and absorb very sizable flows of funds that they hadn't anticipated, certainly 6 or 8 years back. And so they are busy. They're doing things. They're running programs. They're digesting the impacts. They're engaging in exchanges around tradecraft and organizational matters and the like. And there's still a strong culture of protest and as a social movement, which was the roots of this community. But it is changing, and I think it's predominantly treatment referenced or treatment biased in a sense. And it makes for an uneasy kind of ability to kind of really get a strong focus on the prevention agenda. I think the domestic data that CDC brought forward did just that, but it was absent, I think, in much of the discussion around Africa, although none of us were able to really see all of those sessions, and I'm certain there's some that I missed. I'd be interested also in hearing from you and from Craig and Kevin as to what they think the impact was within the American media and opinion environment here in the United States of having had two successive conferences on our borders, one to the north and one to the south. You're getting closer, and what did it have? And how do we begin to estimate whether it had a significant impact by media picking up and conveying back to an American audience, or was it fairly marginal? I mean, when I asked people here, I think the friends who didn't have any special interest in HIV but would watch the media, I think that they felt that there was very strong coverage and very very good quality coverage. But I'd like to hear from you. But thank you all for your presentations. This is a terribly rich presentation.
So before we turn to your questions, I actually was going to let Craig have the last word on some of the observations Steve made on the conference and respond to some of those. And just to offer a couple other observations on my part, as someone who's been going to these conferences, and I don't think Craig mentioned this, that this is the largest international health conference of any sort at all, where more than 20,000 people actually gather to focus on a common area that everyone's working on from different perspectives. But one of the unique things, besides it being so large, is this aspect that Steve alluded to of majority of the people or many of the people involved in the day-to-day work are affected themselves, whether directly or family members, friends, et cetera. And that's a unique aspect of responding to this epidemic that we just can't lose sight of. It really creates a different sense of a meeting. It's not just a meeting. It's real. It's about people's lives, and it's very obvious. And that is still evident for those of you who've never been to a conference. It's really amazing that half of the attendees were new attendees. For those of you who have not been, do your best to try to go to one of these because it's a quite amazing experience. And the second thing I want to raise something that was mentioned that I hadn't thought of before, but noticed when I was there. This issue of what having a big conference like that does to the population that lives in a city. All of us who were there, I'm sure, had similar conversations where you're walking around, meeting people at restaurants, in a taxi, and you have the conversation about HIV. That has to have some impact in people's lives, whether it's just raising awareness, prompting them to think about this more. But that's an important aspect of these conferences that we can't lose sight of as well. So I appreciate whoever mentioned that. So I will stop. I will let Craig offer any other comments, and then we'll turn to all of you.
Thanks, Jen. I really do want to open it up to the audience, but there's a couple of points that I want to respond to from Steve's summary, which, you know, on the whole, I think really reflected what went on. But I think it's important to respond to your comment about the science. You know, there has been so much science in HIV in the last 25 years. We know so much about how to prevent and how to treat HIV from the scientific perspective. We know that condoms work. We know that circumcision works. We know that clean needles and syringes work for drug users. We know that substitution therapy for heroin addicts works. We know that treatment of other sexually transmitted infections reduces the vulnerability to HIV. We know that antiretroviral treatment prevents transmission of HIV from women to their babies, from post-exposure, from pre-exposure, and most likely from chronic treatment. We have 28 different drugs now in HIV, including new classes that emerged in the last year and a half. Drugs that are so much gentler than the earlier years, which enable people to be treated earlier and enable people to take treatment long-term without the kind of side effects we saw in 1996, 97, 98. We have rapid testing. We have incidence testing. And then we know on the other side of things that protecting the rights of homosexuals, of sex workers, of drug users, and of people living with HIV and AIDS themselves helps to enable people to come forward either for prevention services or treatment. But we still got 85 countries in the world that criminalize homosexuality, for God's sake. 7 of them that kill people for being homosexuals, including Sudan, Somalia, Bangladesh, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Nigeria. And it's important to name those countries because it's an outrageous situation. Even in the countries who have full and equal rights for homosexuals, there's still discrimination. Why do we still spend the bulk of our money for drug use on police enforcement instead of on rehabilitation, on education, and on control? Why do we continue to criminalize sex workers instead of protecting them, controlling them, regulating them, and giving them access to health care? I mean, it's a question of political commitment. It would be wonderful to have a vaccine. It would be wonderful to have a microbicide. We're not going to have a vaccine for decades. We don't need a vaccine. If we implemented everything we have, we would end this epidemic in about 50 years. That's one comment. I'm not going to address that. The second one quickly on Africa. I think you're right. I think there was more political leadership than Toronto, though. We had Mohai in the opening. There was the South African vice president was there. There were many more African presenters and researchers there presenting, you know, really good work. I think there's evidence of increased capacity in terms of implementation and research in Africa, and that was evident. But you're right, we need more political leadership in Africa. I mean, the last thing I want to say is it's absolutely true, and it's absolutely ironic that the United States is leading the way in terms of providing financing for the global response. And the reauthorization of PEPFAR was extraordinary. Of course, there have been political interferences in PEPFAR and how services are implemented, but none of the other G8 countries have coughed up the money to do what they all committed to in 2005 at Gleneagles, to provide universal access. So it's amazing that after 8 years of the Bush administration, the legacy will be, I think, the positive legacy of this administration will be what it has done for AIDS globally. And that is extraordinary, should be celebrated, and should be leveraged to get the rest of the rich countries to cough up the money that they should to do what they said they would do.
Well, thank you. This is always a lively discussion. I'll add one more thought in the moderator's prerogative, that despite our best wishes to not do this, we're so oriented around a curative approach that we hear things like the science was disappointing when that really translates to there's no cure. And I think we have to guard against that because, as Craig mentioned, that's there's a lot of science. That ultimate goal that many have is one that's in the future, hopefully. So, but I think it sort of it's either that or there's no science, and there's so much rich science that we need to understand better. I believe we are hoping to have somebody from the Mexican embassy. The chief of staff to the ambassador was going to come and provide a short comment, but I think he was here and had to step out. So we'll take your questions, and why don't we get three questions, and then we'll let our panelists respond. One here, one there, and then one there.
Buenas tardes. This question is directed to Dr. Fenton. Dr. Fenton, we last spoke, if you recall, at the Latino consultation in April in Atlanta. And we spoke about the growing challenge the Latino community is having in the U.S. Coincidentally, to the start of the international conference here, in the, we've learned that the CDC does not include Puerto Rico, the fifth largest concentration of HIV/AIDS in the country in some of its surveillance data. Along with that, we learned that the CDC defunded eight states and Puerto Rico from some of the surveillance grant funds that is needed for this new surveillance strategy. Some of those states include Georgia and Illinois, which have large Latino populations. Similarly, we learned that we've known for a while that states with large Latino populations like California are not included in the overall data because their data is not mature and hasn't entered into the system and won't enter the system into 2012. And finally, we know that undocumented immigrant population is not well assessed. We're not certain what the incidence of the data in that population is. This last point is very important,
just
Stephen.
Can you ask a question?
Sure.
Just so we can
The question is, isn't there the potential to underestimate the incidence of the epidemic in the Latino population?
Thanks. That's one question. I think we have another here.
Yeah. Hi, David Bryden with Global AIDS Alliance. I was wondering if you could comment, maybe Steve or Craig or any of the other panelists. We've heard a lot about the $48 billion. And the praise for the $48 billion. And wanted to know if you could just comment on what you see the prospects for actually seeing that provided. What we have is a situation now for fiscal year 2009 where the same legislators who voted for that $48 billion turned around and then ignored the bill largely in marking up the FY09 appropriations bill. So, for instance, the Global Fund, which is a terrific way to leverage more money, as you said, and that's an important way to do that. It's been essentially no increase for the Global Fund compared to FY08. So part of that is actually the Democrats in Congress cutting the international affairs budget below, $1.5 billion below what the president requested. How do you see us getting to the level of foreign assistance not only on HIV/AIDS, but also on closely related issues of tuberculosis? Because obviously it's the tuberculosis program that's going to suffer the most in a sense from that kind of appropriations decision, because for the tuberculosis program, it's supposed to be new money, right? It's a new, essentially a new program.
Actually, it was back behind you. Okay, the next one.
My name is Mary Jennings. I'm with the American Medical Student Association, and I wanted to ask a question specifically for Craig. You gave a long list of harm reduction methods just recently at the end of your talk, but earlier you mentioned that you had you discussed how you had no answer to the origins of controversy over the view that treatment is treatment as a form of prevention. I wanted to ask you to consider what you might think that this proposed focus on treatment might be to public support for harm reduction programs, such as increasing condoms, such as increasing funding for needle exchange programs for IV drug users, and teaching safer sex practices, managing pregnancy, etc. Is my question clear? Okay, thank you.
So we have our first three questions. Kevin, I'll put you on the spot to answer. Yeah.
So thank you so much for the question on the CDC's response to HIV/AIDS among Latinos and specifically about surveillance data for Hispanics and Latinos. So there are a number of things that you mentioned in your talk, and I just wanted to, in your question, I just want to, first of all, confirm that we have been working with Puerto Rico, and we're looking forward to Puerto Rico releasing its own HIV incidence estimate, because they were funded as part of the initial round of sites for HIV incidence in the United States. So there will be HIV incidence data for Puerto Rico. We did not include Puerto Rico or any of the other U.S. territories in the estimates that were presented in Mexico City, because those estimates were for the continental United States. And we're hoping that over time, hopefully with expansions of resources for measuring HIV incidence, we'll be able to ensure that we're mapping out HIV incidence and including both the U.S., continental U.S., as well as the territories. Your other point was about the non-inclusion of Hispanics, especially in large states where we have large Hispanic populations. Now, for the HIV incidence estimates, we believe that this would not really affect the estimates for Latinos, in part because we adjust the HIV incidence estimate based upon AIDS data, which is comprehensive across the United States. So we have AIDS data for all states and territories in the United States, and certainly for the continental U.S., so we're able to adjust the HIV incidence estimate based on the AIDS data. So therefore, we're confident that the estimates that we have for Hispanics and Latinos will remain robust as we move forward. And then finally, you mentioned this whole aspect of undocumented individuals in the United States, which is something that we are particularly concerned about in the United States. Over the past few years, the rhetoric around immigration and illegal immigration has really had a lot of intended as well as unintended consequences as far as public health is concerned. One of the big concerns we have, as you mentioned, is individuals who may be infected with HIV not seeking care, or going back to their countries of origin, becoming HIV infected and having impacts within Mexico, in the Caribbean, etc. So clearly, part of what we try to do is to reiterate messages around the importance of open access to HIV testing, the importance of prevention messages which go out to all communities in the United States, whether, you know, we don't stratify by documented or undocumented Latinos in the United States, and ensuring that we are working with our local partners and CBOs to better understand the magnitude of this factor in the U.S. epidemic and to be able to adjust to it. But clearly, there are always going to be populations that are going to be undercounted. For example, for blacks from the Caribbean, because we're looking at blacks overall in the U.S., we know that many Afro-Caribbeans are not identified and we're not able to target them at the national level. And this occurs as well for Hispanic and Latino populations. So thank you for your questions and thank you for your points. And I hope that this has really helped to address some of the things you raised.
Stephen and Craig, on the $48 billion question from David, I think this, you know, on the one hand, the fact that global health is driving the foreign assistance agenda in so many ways, or funding, I don't think a lot of us, in terms of the chunk it's now representing, I don't think a lot of us would have thought that many years ago, that we would be where we are. So that's an interesting perspective. But I think we're also talking about the budget reality that we're in, and so the larger budget reality that's not specific to the foreign assistance budget. I don't know, Steve, if you want to comment on that, and then Craig, from your where you see.
Well, the you know, there's this dramatic historic authorization that has occurred. That does not mean, that does not guarantee that the money will come in at the levels and with the timing that would be necessarily envisioned. It does create a commitment. It's a remarkable commitment. It's a bipartisan, bicameral, and commitment with the signature of the signatures of the leadership of both parties in the White House, and leadership of Congress. And I think that matters reputationally and morally to a very significant degree, and I wouldn't jump to the wrong conclusions too rapidly that somehow we're going to have a terrible shortfall. However, I also believe that we're in a particularly difficult cycle right now. There's a significant prospect of a continuing resolution. There is the reality that Congress is approaching its day of reckoning, by which the
use of supplemental financing for the wars, which is running at about $12 billion per month, is going to probably end. The debt and deficit numbers that were released last week were staggering, and the projections into the next year are staggering. And we're in a period of domestic distress, unlike, you know, with a very uncertain endpoint. No one knows whether the events of this weekend were the beginning of a catastrophe or the end phase of a catastrophe, and the bottom is not known. So all of those factors are ones which I think argue for an exceptional level of vigilance and care in looking at this. But also, if we did not have that reauthorization legislation, it would be a disaster, I think. If you didn't have that very clear commitment and embrace of that, that gives you a certain amount of defense on this. There's also a broader debate around foreign aid reform, which is upon us, which could cut in any number of directions. But I believe that what has happened inadvertently in the last 8 years is that HIV/AIDS and global health have come to be the principal drivers of U.S. foreign assistance. For better or for worse, that's the reality that within which we live today.
Craig?
I don't have much to add to those very wise and eloquent remarks, Steve, other than to say that armed with the authorization, civil society now has responsibility and the tool to hold up to say, stick to your commitments. And at the end of the day, it'll be a question of priorities around appropriations and a question of lobbying and pressure from civil society. Oh, I'm going to take this last question. I hope you don't all misinterpret me. I'm not trying to pitch treatment over prevention, and quite the opposite. Combine. I was being a little bit facetious when I said I don't know why there's such a controversy about accepting the fact that treatment does have an impact on a positive impact on transmission. The reason why there's that controversy is because it means, I think, that if we are really going to treat people much, much earlier throughout the world, then it's going to cost a lot more money at the beginning. And what I think, though, is that in the end, we could actually end the epidemic in 50, 60, 70 years if we front-loaded our spending, tested people regularly, implemented rapid testing programs around the world, and then treated on diagnosis. In order to do that, we have to make sure that we protect people from discrimination, particularly from ridiculous laws criminalizing HIV transmission, the laws in more than 60 countries that still prevent people from entering or staying, that the travel restrictions that persist around the world, the fact that people with HIV have difficulties getting insurance. All of these things need to be dealt with, but you know, quite frankly, in addition to all those harm reduction tools you mentioned, which are critical, we've got to test people regularly. We've got to treat people earlier. Got to keep people alive and productive. And then we'll see also an impact on transmission. So all of these things aren't in competition with one another at all, in my mind.
One thought on your question as well, that the one thing I think we should guard against or think about is that to the extent we can look at the data and see the treatment impact on transmission, that is not to say that the other interventions that you mentioned are not still needed. So the combination message becomes quite important because of the tendency to latch on to treatment and medical interventions. Maybe that was what you were getting at. Anyway, I think we're ready for three more questions. And since I cut you off, we'll start with you, and then we'll go back there.
I have one anecdotal answer to the question about media coverage that was asked. And then I have a small question also. In a very unofficial consumerist approach to the media, you were fighting the Olympics, and every day I opened the Washington Post and the New York Times to see what was going to be featured. And I was pretty pleasantly surprised by those two newspapers that generally the left-hand front page column had something on the AIDS conference. I don't think I heard anything on network television from any of the three major networks. So that's my answer to your question about the media. And then, Dr. Fenton, you mentioned prevention toolkits. I'd like to know what those consist of and who gets them and how.
Well, let's take two more questions.
Sure.
I think there's some over here, between the two, one of you.
It was really encouraging to hear both you, Mr. McClure, and Dr. Fenton acknowledge the clear message from housing advocates for more focus on the role of homelessness, poverty in prevention and health care. And the National AIDS Housing Coalition was pleased to sponsor a housing satellite meeting at the conference along with Housing Works, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and the Ontario HIV Treatment Network. And we presented a housing declaration to the IAS at that meeting. Thank you for accepting that. My question is, moving forward to 2010 in Vienna, are there more plans, are there plans afoot to more fully integrate housing and other structural determinants of health into the conference proper through a plenary speaker or call for abstracts, et cetera?
And I've been neglectful to ask people to identify who they are, so please let us.
Nancy Bernstein from the National AIDS Housing Coalition.
Okay, one more question. There was somebody I had called on. Oh, you spoke at the last one of these, so we should. It's only fitting to.
Hi, Marcia Martin, and actually on behalf of my adopted home and my former home, of course, we'd love to have the International AIDS Conference in Washington, D.C., or Oakland, California, and I know you know the Oakland dialogue. But I really actually have a question about the treatment prevention, and it's actually, I think, Craig, I think it's a very important discussion that it would be nice to have in debate form at some of these international meetings where we really can have a full discussion. But looking at the data that Kevin presented, it looks like when we really did start aggressive treatment, at least in the U.S., the spiking happened around that time, and then we see a gradual coming down and a kind of leveling off where we looks like we've plateaued around some kind of effectiveness around treatment and effectiveness around behavioral interventions and effectiveness around something. I don't know yet, but I would want to know if the two of you could comment on what looks like a trend, because you look at the chart and you go back and it looks like when we really got aggressive around treatment, we started to see something happen. And whatever that something is, it would be really nice for us to begin to talk about it on the local level, regional levels, try to figure out, you know, more money for treatment, but more money for behavioral and some combination of the two, and can we begin to discern what we think is really happening there?
So three questions are the toolkit, the housing and structural interventions for the next conference, and then this last one on can we see any treatment effect in the U.S. incidence data?
Okay. Thanks for your questions. So the prevention toolkit is actually a metaphorical phrase. It really is. We use it to describe the range of prevention interventions which we have, whether it's HIV testing, partner services, evidence-based interventions, etc. And when I use it, certainly it's to really paint a picture of what we have in terms of the armament against the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and to critically look at where we need to add to the toolkit in terms of interventions which can help us to target the populations who are even now becoming affected by the disease, or populations such as men who have sex with men who have been affected by the disease since the beginning of the epidemic, but for whom prevention, research, and interventions have not kept pace of their needs. So it's a metaphorical phrase which I use just
but,
to...
But if I may suggest, I think the physical reality is a damn good idea.
As well? Okay. Thank you.
We do have the interventions
that you packed up. We do. And as far as if you visit the CDC website, you know, we've been working very hard to do systematic reviews of the literature to identify the most effective behavioral interventions, which we call EBIs, as well as to identify those interventions which can be packaged and disseminated and used at the community level. for targeting high-risk behaviors or to reduce HIV or STD incidence. So there are tools that CDC and our partners use and encourage the use of at the local level to accelerate our prevention efforts. So that's how the term is being used. Shall I just tackle the last one? Okay. Marcia, thank you for your question on the trends and how we can interpret those trends in light of the context of changes in antiretroviral scale-up in the United States. I think there are multiple things which are going on, and it's a very complex picture. So in the 1980s, I suspect that some of the declines in incidence that we saw were explained by population-wide behavioral modification. So people were dying all around us. And all levels of society were reducing numbers of partner acquisition, using condoms. There were behavioral modifications which were taking place at a population-wide level. Also remember in the 1980s that there was tremendous death which was occurring as a result of HIV/AIDS. And certain mathematical modeling studies have suggested that the differential mortality of gay and bisexual men perhaps accelerated some of the declines because we're losing individuals from the denominator, so to speak, for the population at risk. Now, specifically as it relates to treatment, I would look at the line from 2000 to 2007, where despite the fact that we have more people living with HIV, we have seen a relative stabilization, in fact, a flatlining of HIV incidence since that time. And we know from other data sources that the transmission rate of HIV over time is declining. So in other words, given that more people are living with HIV, you would expect more HIV transmissions to be occurring, but in fact it's going in the opposite direction. So that suggests that both positive people are taking steps to protect themselves and their loved ones and their sexual partners or their partners. But it also suggests that as we're scaling up these prevention interventions, we're beginning to see an impact. So I think the take-home message is prevention works. And we need to move beyond the questioning as to whether or not prevention works. Are we doing the right thing? What is the balance? For me, Mexico City was about strong advocacy for combination prevention, not pitting one against the other, but thinking about comprehensive approaches. Mexico is also about moving upstream. And Mexico is also about understanding the patterns of the epidemics and beginning to say, where are we having success? Where do we need to accelerate our efforts with prevention?
I guess so. Not much more to add to that. I think it's on that question, though, it's important to remember, I can't remember what the percentage is in the U.S., but globally more than 50% of people don't know that they're HIV positive. So this need to dramatically
80.
Dramatically scale up testing. And this issue of kind of complacency related to treatment. Sometimes I hear the way some people express that you know, there's been some complacency around sexual behavior ever since treatment became available. Well, of course there has. As you said, Kevin, you know, people aren't dying all around us in our country. So, of course people are going to be somewhat more complacent. It's strange how I sometimes hear that message as if it's the individual's fault instead of the fact that, yes, of course, when you eliminate death and dying around you from a disease, that people start to fear that disease less. And then you've got the other issues of incredible use of methamphetamines, cocaine, ecstasy that act as sexual disinhibitors that kind of complicate things around the impact of treatment on transmission. The reduction in sex education in the last 10 years for youth, the reduction in prevention information. I'm talking more about Canada now, but I know the same situation is true to an extent here, reduction in prevention information for young gay men. You know, there are some things that people don't often talk about, but that we need to remember that condoms, I think, were never meant to be a permanent solution to HIV. And this is why you saw these dramatic increases in condom use in the first 5 to 10 years of the epidemic, particularly in gay men. And it's been well studied and written about, that the change in behavior amongst gay men in developed countries in the 80s and early 90s was a behavior change, sexual behavior change, never seen before in the history of humanity. And it was always pitched as a short-term change. So we need to kind of rethink the messaging a little bit. If we want societies to make condoms a part of the future forever of sexual behavior, then we need to start talking about it. Because certainly what we did in the 80s and 90s was really talk about it as a short-term solution to what we hoped would be a short-term problem. The question about housing, you're really ahead of the game. I mean, we just finished Mexico. The committees are just being formed for Vienna. But absolutely, I mean, there is the need to include structural determinants in a more comprehensive way, including housing. Poverty is certainly important. But it's something that's been a feature of the conference, maybe needs to be highlighted more in the future, but no plans as yet as to how what that might look like.
Because I think we're in our last round of questions. One here. And then up front first. And then we'll go back there. And then there was somebody over here who hadn't asked a question. So.
Hi, my name is... My name is Susie Peel, and I had the privilege of serving as the scientific coordinator of the Geneva Conference 10 years ago. And there are only half as many people, so it's different. I'd like to say one small thing about the content. The science tends to happen at the retrovirus conference, so the World AIDS Conference is one among many. What I would love to see coming out of maybe Vienna, or and I don't know if it came out of Mexico, was a little more on structural factors, and Kevin, you alluded to them, the obstacles to implementation. Given what's been said here and what we read, we know very much. But what about illiteracy? I've heard an awful lot of other things, but nobody has mentioned that. Was that addressed at the conference? Because there's such a huge correlation with HIV. Thank you.
Question back there.
Hi, my name is Jamila Taylor with the Center for Health and Gender Equity, and my question is actually for Dr. Fenton. How can the U.S. become a model like we have been with, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief? How can we become a model and a leader in addressing HIV within our own borders?
Okay, one more question. I'm just going to see if there's somebody else who hadn't asked one yet. Is there anybody else? Sorry, David.
Hi, my name is Cassie Roth, and I'm with CSIS. And this question is for Catherine, and it's specifically about Mexico. But you talked about how many women leaders began discussing the feminization of AIDS in Latin America. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about innovation from Mexico to the U.S., and then men bringing that back to Mexico and kind of spreading the infection rate to different populations within the country.
Who wants to do Catherine?
The coalition, it's a long name, but I think it's the Coalition of First Ladies and Women Leaders on AIDS in Latin America, met, as I understand it, for the fifth time in Mexico just prior to the conference. And the meeting, I believe, was attended by at least four first ladies from the region, as well as I think over 200 delegates from a variety of other countries around the region. And, you know, among the issues that they addressed were the increasing feminization of the epidemic in the region, and also ways to promote the empowerment of women with respect to their own sexual and reproductive health, to become advocates and activists for their needs within the larger set of issues related to HIV/AIDS. I didn't attend that session, so I don't know the extent to which they addressed immigration per se. However, there were a number of very interesting sessions on the question of migration from Mexico to the United States and the transit of migrants from Central America and other places through Mexico to the United States. And among the questions that were taken up were, you know, the ways in which the migration process changes thinking about perceptions of risk on the part of migrants, and also expectations about sexual behavior, and also expectations or understandings about risk in their home communities. And among the many interesting studies on some of those panels was a lot of work focused on southern Mexico and California in particular, and some of the history of migration that has happened, you know, among those communities, and, you know, really urging greater attention to, you know, the ways in which people, you know, think about sexuality within the family, think about how migration, you know, may shape that process when people are going to be separated for a number of years at a time, and how that shapes their understanding of risk as well.
There was a question on illiteracy, and I don't know. And then and then anyone who wants to offer a final thought from the panel, please, because we're just about out of time.
Exactly. How can we become a model? I probably want to put on the table that in many ways we are already a model. You know, you look at the research that the U.S. has been leading into methods to prevent and control and treat this epidemic. The U.S. has certainly been at the forefront. The work of the NIH, the work of CDC has certainly been at the forefront for prevention tools and prevention methodologies, working with communities. And yes, there are ways in which we can enhance what we do. But certainly, I trained and worked in Europe for many years, and the U.S. was always seen as a sort of dominant force when it came to investments in the domestic epidemic, looking at new tools to tackle the epidemic, and partnering in a way and providing global leadership, as you've seen with PEPFAR. I guess what I hear you saying, however, is how do we begin to harness this in a much more effective way to focus on the domestic epidemic? And that's perhaps one of the areas where you've heard the advocates talk about the need for national coordination in a way that we have not done coordination before in the United States, getting federal agencies to truly talk to each other and partner with each other in a much stronger, much more effective way towards a single HIV goal, getting federal government to work more effectively with communities, with faith communities, with business sectors, etc., on a single unified HIV goal. Perhaps that is where, when we look to the future, that is where we need to be enhancing our prevention efforts. And that's where we can truly provide another form of global leadership on HIV/AIDS. So I want to just, I wouldn't want anybody to leave thinking that we're not doing great things in the US and things that we should be proud of. We are. And now it's about enhancing and accelerating our prevention efforts domestically. And then second, I wanted to respond to the literacy part. Thank you for raising that. We at CDC are very committed now, as part of our prevention agenda, to moving upstream and to look at focusing on the social determinants of health as part of the combination prevention approach which you've heard about. And yes, as an agency, we're very aware of health literacy and illiteracy as a whole and its impact on health outcomes for Americans of all walks of life. And later this year, we'll be holding the first social determinants meeting in our national center, which is really going to be looking at ways in which we can look at the evolving literature on social determinants of health and begin to think, well, how do we apply this to the U.S. context in focusing on HIV, hepatitis, TB, and STD prevention? How do we, as a federal agency, begin to move upstream in a much more coordinated manner and take with us or partner more effectively across federal agencies in that journey? So this is going to be an exciting meeting for us, and certainly under my leadership, this is certainly something that I'm very, very committed to as far as prevention is concerned.
I'll just say globally on that issue of illiteracy as one issue, but of structural determinants of HIV vulnerability and of health. I mean, it's always been, to me, one of the most compelling things about working to respond against AIDS has been that AIDS really exposes the ugly underbelly of our societies in so many different ways, whether it's about discrimination against minorities, whether they're racial or ethnic or sexual minorities or migrants, whether it's about the rights of women versus men, the differential access to health throughout the world and to development. So these are really important things to the conference and to the response. As an optimist, I do think, though, on the issue of access to information related to literacy, that the world is becoming a flatter place, to quote a famous popular author. It's becoming a flatter place where people have much greater access to information than they did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I think that's a great sign. I also think that that how people take up that information that they have access to in ever-increasing ways is what's going to shape the future. And there are many competing issues for attention to those in the world who care about the world. But the fact that people who do care and who do want to change things have so much greater access to information, I think, is something that's really gives me hope for the future.
And since I'm an optimist too, and like to end on optimistic notes, I think we'll end here. Some of us will be staying up if others have questions. And I just want to thank everyone for coming and staying till 5 o'clock on a Monday to hear about a conference that already happened. but I really do think it speaks to the power of the conference as a moment to really move us forward in a discussion. And this meeting is webcast, and again, the conference itself has many of the sessions were webcast. We encourage you to use that as a resource for other work and other meetings you may have. There's also several other post-Mexico City discussion venues that are happening in the near future, so this can continue on. So thank you all for coming. Thanks to CSIS as well for partnering.